Okay. Well, this is a continuation of an oral history interview with Harry Cello, conducted by Christophe Lecuyer and David Brock, taking place on the 7th of January, 2005, in Menlo Park. And to go into the story of your transition from Shell Development to Shockley Semiconductor in 1957, could you tell us a bit about what acquaintance you might have had with William Shockley, with the transistor at the time when leading up to the point where you actually got a phone call from William Shockley?
Well, while I was at Shell, I knew nothing of the work of William Shockley. He got the Nobel Prize, and one keeps knowledge of this kind of thing, but it was in a field that was interesting to me, but and read about it, but it was all publicity mm-hmm. kind of reading. Mm-hmm. Then I got the call, and that sort of you know, energized things all over. And we talked a couple of times on the telephone, and he asked me about the work I was doing and if I was doing anything with semiconductors. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had to scratch to try to figure out where I was connected to semiconductors. But there was an interesting connection, I believe I mentioned before, the catalysis of chemical compounds. Simple chemical compounds into bigger molecules was carried on using cuprous oxide. Right. And cuprous oxide was always classified as a semiconductor. It's not a conductor, it's not an insulator, it's a semiconductor. Mm-hmm. And it changes color. Mm-hmm. And if you watch a glass tube and you see pumping in one end, you're pumping in propylene, and at the other end out is coming alcohol. You know, ethyl alcohol or propyl alcohol or whatever, and you can see the reaction zone, and you can see this blue-red fluctuation within the catalyst. And we knew that when it was blue, it was dead. Mm-hmm. You could stop the reaction with a convenient kind of thing. You could examine it.
Right.
And I was curious prior to the phone call. I was curious about semiconductivity. Mm-hmm. You know, so I read a little bit of the work of some of the guys in physics who were concerned with semiconductors, with nothing to do with silicon or germanium. These were compounds which had conductivity themselves. And I had the crazy idea that if I could stick a couple of electrodes into the tube and hook them right up to the catalyst, we knew when it was blue, the catalyst was dead. Well, if it was a conductor while it was working, would it be a non-conductor when it wasn't working?
Right.
And a few sporadic attempts at that never got anywhere. Couldn't figure out a way to hook on to the contact. And if the currents, if they were there, were so tiny that there was no way of, not to me, no way of amplifying them to look at anything. Mm-hmm. And it was a research project that was not exactly supported by Shell. It was a kind of a semi-bootleg project, a very short one. Mm-hmm. But that was definitely raised the term semiconductor. Mm-hmm. And again, I saw that coming up with respect to a Gordon research conference that was held about that same period of time. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole session on conductivity of various organic materials, solids, not the kind of conductivity they talk about today of the organic molecules, but the inorganic solids, cuprous oxide, sulfides, others. Mm-hmm. So that the word semiconductor was bouncing around in my head at that time, coincidentally. I believe it was entirely coincidentally.
And what did he... Could you describe those initial phone conversations that you had with him?
Well, I told him about the same story.
Right.
He was Shockley. If it wasn't on his point, he wasn't interested. I mean, he was curious about what I had been exposed to. Couple of questions, he and I realized that I didn't know anything about band gap theory or any of the solid state transitions that were occurring at that time in the field of true semiconductors. Nobody could write a band gap description of cuprous oxide. You'd see nothing but intermixing curves and a mess that you couldn't define. It had nothing to do with that. He said, well, why don't you come on down and let's talk down here and tell me a little bit more about your work.
And how did he describe what his firm was getting up to?
Well, he was no shrinking violet, so he immediately started out with the Nobel Prize had just been awarded a year earlier, and he was accumulating a group of people to work in the field of silicon. Did I know silicon? I said, no, only as a component in sand. This kind of thing. Always trying to impress him a little bit, you know, or that I wasn't totally cold. But that never worked with Shockley. he just shucked that off. Alyssa was right to the point and worked. So we talked about my work at Shell. And he mentioned a little bit about what they were doing. He gathered this group of people. He said, I've got 14 or so free-running PhDs, and they're all doing what they want. And sometimes I know what they're doing, and sometimes I don't know what they're doing. And they don't bother to answer all the times, but I don't expect them to. So it was, what did he call them, 14... free-running PhDs, that kind of thing. Then, of course, before we go much further, I'd like you to take a few tests. That was the next conversation. Once I had decided I'd like to go further, he was very he was very particular about that. He didn't want to go on another single step any further than he had to. He was a very jealously guarding man of proprietary details of what he was up to. Later, it came out many times that there was a big focus on him from BTL, from Bell Laboratories, from other places where his colleagues had gone. And everybody was in his field were very interested to see what he was up to. Where his research was going, because this was a research organization that he had organized, research and development organization, you could say. And he used to, he was very proprietary oriented, in fact, to a point of being paranoid about it. Be very careful to whom you talk, because the moment you tell them something about what you're doing and it's with Shockley, then they're all going to go do the same thing. That was the attitude. So very, very proprietary. It was something I was not that used to at Shell Development, which was also proprietary because we had to get patents and things. But he had a different aura about his work. And I did mention about the examinations.
So was that before you even went down to visit the operation?
Before I went down to visit the operation.
And so he wanted you to have this battery of tests, psychological tests?
There was a weekend of tests in San Francisco, not down at the Shockley Semiconductor Laboratories.
Was it at?
At a hotel. It was conducted in darkened chambers at a hotel. We've been talking about the Ukrainians.
Was it just you and consultants or something?
Yeah, there were a couple of consultants. He was there, and he would step in to see what the progress was.
So he would be there for the whole weekend as well?
Whole weekend, yes. Saturday and Sunday.
Did you have any social contact with him, or was he just checking
in? No, he was just checking. I kind of was I didn't know quite how to take that, you know. It could be very loose and easy. Well, anything you want, we can do. Absolutely. Why all this? Not secrecy. Secrecy was something else. But why all this effort to judge my mental stability? So I took the liberty of asking him a couple of times, had he taken these tests?
What did he say?
He said, well, yes, I have. I'll tell you the results after I see yours.
Did he ever do that?
He did. He did, but not in detail. He didn't answer the psychological parts. If it was a question of physical data, you know, when was this invented or when was that invented, something like that. But I asked him if what was his interpretation of that thematic apperception test, in which the man is standing by the side of a woman in the bed, and at her bed, and it's dark, and the question was, please describe in one paragraph what he's thinking. And I asked him, what did you think were going on? I can't really say that he was a little bit miffed, but he didn't expect the question. And he said, well, take them all and we'll talk about it afterwards. At the end of those tests, at the end of the 2 days, he said, you did fairly well considering they were new to you. Mine were a little better. I didn't know what he meant by better, because, well, what are you... He said, but I passed and you passed.
And then was it soon thereafter that you went to?
Then I went down to visit the operation. I went to visit the operation. I met with, at the time, all the guys that were there.
Right.
But mostly Noyce and Moore. They were sort of the kingpins of the operation. It was introduced to them. And it was a one-day visit. And then after that, I had to make the commitment. I didn't pay too much attention to it at the time. I see now why. But I was warned by Noyce and Moore that there were problems. Okay. They had taken the psychological test. I said, does everybody take the test? As far as they knew, yes, including Shockley. And they said, well, the old man's kind of paranoid about some of these things, and there are problems here, and I'm sure he's trying to solve some of them. And then at a later visit, he's trying to avoid, not solve, trying to avoid. He kept putting it in the category of, well, you know, is this man fit physically, scientifically, for this organization coming from Michelle Development? But he did have some questions about some of my work at Shell, and there, later it turns out that he had a perfectly good reason for wanting somebody to come aboard with that experience.
Could you?
And that was the organic chemical part of it.
Okay.
That I was familiar with organic chemistry. And they were having a raft of problems at Shockley on resist problems.
A
tremendous number of resist problems. Among other things, and Shockley was trying to... do some work, get some work done in that area to where they could ease those problems. So I started on a, I started...
You could talk about the resist problems.
Right. I started to look into, he was thinking of, he said, could you do anything with wax evaporation? And I asked him, what did he mean by wax evaporation, you know? Tons of waxes, and they all have boiling points. But they were using, it was the practice in the semiconductor industry to use black wax, that tarry, gummy-looking stuff that comes in sticks, black sticks. It's, it's a derivative of a petroleum product. It's a we call it a bottoms product. Of a distillation, what's left over is black wax. So I knew what black wax was, but that covers a multitude. And they were using it to as an etch resist. You'd glue down a wafer to a surface, to a glassy surface, or to a metal surface or something, and you'd glue it down with this black wax, and overlap the edge of the wafer with the wax, and you could dunk it in various things.
Right.
To hydrofluoric acid, mostly, and mm-hmm. nitric acid, and it would resist.
Mm-hmm.
But the black wax was, it was a staple of the organization of semiconductor work, even for the next 5 years. And we were using black wax at Fairchild when Fairchild was coming up, came up with integrated circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Black wax still had its place.
Mm-hmm. Where, sorry to interrupt, but where, was it commonly available? Where did you get the black
wax? Oh, yeah,
wax?
You could get it. That was a laboratory chemical.
Just from a laboratory supply
catalog? That's right.
Catalog?
You could get it from, yes.
Huh.
That was a very easy thing to do.
Actually, I was wondering, would Shockley be using KPR?
Yes.
Okay.
They were just. This was one specific purpose.
Okay.
You couldn't do a very good job of masking with this.
Mm-hmm.
You could glue it, glue down things. You could etch a whole wafer or a part of one.
Okay.
Etch the top and not hit the bottom.
Right.
With black wax, but it was always anything you could do. You had to smear it around by hand or with little probe, hot probes and stuff like that.
Okay.
It was just a carrier wax.
Right.
Okay.
And he wanted to know, and it was a reasonable question, he wanted to know, is the resistive material in the wax, can that be evaporated?
Mm-hmm.
And if it could be evaporated through a mask.
Oh, I see.
The vapor is going through a mask, sort of like a regular screen material that you have on the board, regular screening, rectangular screen.
Mm-hmm.
You could put on a wafer. You could then etch the wafer into little squares.
Absolutely.
Or into little circles or something that the wax would, if you could get it to evaporate.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time working on a whole derivative series of the Carnauba wax kinds of, I had bottles and jars full of wax from every part of the world. And we'd stick it in a crucible in a vacuum chamber and whatever wanted to evaporate, we'd evaporate through a screen, and it would hit a silicon target.
Uh-huh.
And you could do squares nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if you put, if you did that on silicon, then you could etch the silicon very nicely. The wax really resisted. It was like being able to evaporate black wax.
Right.
But black wax. If you try to heat that, you don't know what's coming off of it. It's a crud. So I spent, my first problem was to see what I could generate in the way of black wax. Now, at the same time, I was asked to work together with Noyce and with Jay Last and a couple of the other guys to see what we could do with KPR.
Okay.
Now, the problem with evaporating wax is that you can evaporate squares and you can evaporate round, complete things, but envision a donut.
Okay.
You cannot evaporate a donut. Because how do you anchor? Not without anchoring the little dot in the center to the periphery on the outside.
Uh-huh.
And if you did that, then where it was connected, it wouldn't etch.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't get the same structure that you thought you were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a variety of shapes, interlocking shapes, that you can't get with a single evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
But he was after the little squares, and the main reason was that he was so anxious to get the PNPN switches out.
Okay.
And they were all, they were etched only once, namely etched out of the wafer after the diffusions were done.
Okay.
So if the wax worked, you could get a whole wafer full of little PNPN squares after diffusion, after total processing.
Okay.
It was an interesting idea,
but
it had its limitations based on geometry, and it never would have worked in later structures at all, in any kind of intricate structures. You'd have to have a little connecting pattern between images.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, you couldn't etch two circles, but if they were connected with a dumbbell, if you wanted to connect and make a dumbbell, can't do that.
Right.
you can't form that in the pattern of the wax.
Huh.
But as I say, he was interested in the PNPN switches, and the KPR was giving the guys a terrible amount of problem. Because the PNPN switches are integral squares.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're all one.
Right.
There's no, and the KPR would lift. If you wanted to etch through the silicon and separate the little squares.
Yes.
you'd have to etch through 40 microns at least or more of silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got a good one where the KPR stuck all the way, that was a good one. But quite frequently, a third to a half of them would wash away at the corners.
Okay.
Would lift.
I see.
We call that the lifting problem. And it got a name that lasted throughout the industry, the witch is back.
Oh,
the lifting witch is back, you know. And we were getting the lifting problems with resist all the time.
Okay.
But KPR was the only way to get images.
Okay.
But he didn't need them for the PNPN switches.
Okay.
He didn't want to work on anything but PNPN.
Interesting. So the KPR was something that was pushed by noise and LAS rather than by Shockley, or...?
Well, they used it.
They used it.
Okay. Of course, they wanted to make transistors.
Yeah,
and you could separate the transistors with KPR, but you couldn't etch the maces, or you couldn't etch do fine etching, because the KPR just wouldn't stick.
Mm.
It was not totally resistant enough. At that time, Kodak came back. We tried some new ones.
Mm-hmm.
We were constantly in touch with them. I was in touch with them for their new stuff. They had one they called KMER, Kodak Metal Etch Resist, and it was a much thicker, heavier kind of thing.
Mm.
And if it stuck, it would last longer than a thin film of KPR.
Okay.
And then they, but it was too heavy. You couldn't do fine structures.
Mm.
And then we jumped on to KTFR, which was Kodak Thin Film Resist.
Mm-hmm.
It was a new one developed in between the two KPR and KMER. KMER were known commercial resists. They're used by metal engravers quite frequently.
Okay.
Etching, for example, printing plates for money.
Oh,
the
okay.
Money plates, okay. They use okay. that kind okay. of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And were you in touch? Who was your opposite number at Kodak when you were dealing with them? Was it a salesperson?
A salesperson,
yeah.
A local distributor.
Okay.
And from time to time, he'd bring somebody in from Kodak. But Kodak wasn't too interested because it didn't account for anything.
Right.
I mean, they could sell two bottles of Kodak a month or something. And Shockley didn't want to put up with those kind of problems. That was not his métier.
Okay.
He said, well, get him to give you some more, or get him to develop something new. But there's no incentive, Dr. Shockley. Well, tell him they'll get rich if it works. And those guys are looking at one order per week, one bottle per week. It was a lot of fun about that topic. They were generally cooperative wherever we could get their interest, because they could see that there were possibilities, but they would mean they would have to launch a research effort themselves or a development effort. As a matter of fact, KTFR didn't come out until about 4 or 5 years after KPR was used.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was HF. The problem was entirely HF. HF crept under the corners and the interface between the KPR and the silicon, and any geometry that you had you tried to preserve would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get these diffraction looking rings.
Oh, interesting.
That would, and we were playing with wafers that were only 40 microns thick.
Right.
Very, very thin. And lots of them were bowed in order to slightly bowed from the lapping that we did on them.
Okay.
And they were slightly bowed, so if you tried to press them onto the KPR and you press too hard, you'd shatter the whole damn wafer and all the diffusion results would disappear.
Oh my gosh.
It had its, he had a good idea, but he went out to find a chemist who knew about wax.
Okay.
That was a starting point.
Okay.
Then there were others. And then he thought that they could put. He wanted somebody to get into the photoresist problem, and the HF and the chemicals.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was one of the motivations.
What was his concern there about the chemicals?
How to use them, HF and nitric acid. I mean, HF is a beast.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be so careful in how to use it, and people would get it under their fingernails. That was the common practice, common evil. Get it under their fingernails, and then wouldn't be able to work because it etched, it irritated a rim. Your fingernail looked like a wafer. But it was a horrible kind of thing to use. And a mixture of HF and nitric acid is one which will dissolve silicon. HF right. will not dissolve silicon. It'll dissolve only the oxide.
Okay.
And that's what was that's what was still good about it years later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You wanted to etch the oxide layer off and right. leave the silicon, you would use HF. Mm-hmm. But then you didn't care about the structure that was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out then, and it's still today a pain in the ass as far as etching problems are concerned. It's more controlled because they've developed it to a high degree. It's more adherent than it was in the early days to silicon.
Mm-hmm.
It was not developed for use on silicon. It was developed for use on a metal engraving,
right.
thin sheets of metal. And for that, it was excellent.
Mm. And where did you?
So that was the, but the problems that I've worked on spread across the whole spectrum.
Right. It sounds like you were dealing with some of the basic chemistry, you know,
yes.
fundamental to
yes.
the technology that was sort
yes.
of cutting across.
The
whatever
only device. Guy that knew any chemistry in the place besides me was Gordon Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And he came from infrared spectroscopy, so he wasn't an honest-to-goodness organic chemist or organic-oriented.
Right.
That's it. And he was the first one to say so. But he's the one who trained me in how to use KPR without wrecking my hands. How to use HF without wrecking my hands, the wax bottles. And
and he
that.
At that time was more on the diffusion side?
Yeah, his job was pretty well concentrated on the diffusion for the PNPN devices.
Hmm.
Shockley tried to get the whole effort going only on PNPN. That was
mm-hmm.
a driving force for him. That was clearly his ambition, and he didn't like anybody else taking time off and doing something else that if it wasn't related to the four-layer diode.
And his big ambition for that was for the
telephone
company?
Switching systems.
Yeah.
Electrically, it would be a marvel. It would take the place of one or more relays in any one of the switching matrices, and there's no mechanical wear.
Right.
It was an animal to try to make. It had to be made very thin.
Mm-hmm.
Because to achieve the switching action, you had to diffuse two junctions
mm-hmm.
on top of the one that was already there and do that all in one diffusion from top side and bottom side. And you had to stand the wafers up.
On end.
And yes, and then they had to come to within a set distance. Each junction
sure.
had to come to within a set distance. If the wafer was not perfectly parallel, lapped perfectly parallel, it would not make parallel junctions.
Oh.
If you can envision
mm-hmm.
that.
I can.
Within, yeah. And that was one problem. The second problem was if it didn't come to within the set distance, you wouldn't get a constant switchover current.
Mm-hmm.
In a PNPN, as you raise the voltage, you know that it pops over into a high conducting state. And the turnover voltage
mm-hmm.
is critically dependent on the distance between the two junctions.
Mm-hmm.
And any given wafer, though small,
mm-hmm.
would produce a scattering of switching voltages.
Okay.
Because if they weren't perfectly parallel to within micron
right.
range,
mm-hmm.
then you'd get a different result from the part that was parallel or closer
right.
than the part that wasn't. And that was controlled by how well you lapped it parallel. So we'd sit around, I mentioned to you, sit around with a wafer under every finger on a lapping plate and try to lap 10 at a time on one side and then turn them over and lap it on the other side.
Now, what's a, could you describe a lapping plate for me? I don't know.
It's a metal plate, a flat metal plate, very much like is used in optics.
Okay.
On a good, like on an optical bench, but it's not quite that, doesn't have to be quite that rigorous. And it's usually a very hard metal of a tantalum base or some sort of a titanium base, a very hard metal, perfectly flat itself, and you would scatter carbide dust on the lapping plate. Very, very fine grit carbide dust. And then you'd lap, you'd let the thing would rotate, and of course you could do one by holding the wafer down.
Oh, the plates rotating.
Yeah, in parallel.
Yeah,
right.
I see.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you did one side at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
So you quickly, the technicians who were good quickly learned how to use all 10 fingers. You can get the way you get a batch of wafers out. Now, even there, you can see where within a micron or two of the distance between junctions, one that you lapped holding here or holding here would be a different voltage. So how do you guarantee that the pressure of your fingers is exactly the right pressure you want?
Oh my gosh.
Later, we learned how to use two parallel lapping plates. Engineer them to within careful distance. But look at what you're working with. You've got 40 microns total space to work with. And these enormous plates themselves have to be parallel to within 40 microns. And you could do this. It took a little bit, it took some engineering, and occasionally we'd get them, but if you wanted to get them out in a hurry, there you were.
Wow.
And did those lapping plates you could get from...
You could buy
like
those,
an optical shop
Yes,
or something?
Yeah, optical like benches, places
right.
where they made optical benches. And there was a lot of metal work going on in the industry, in this industry as well as others. Machining and lapping kind of thing. They were pretty good at making surfaces. They were very good at it. But you see, the point I wanted to make was if you weren't working on a PNPN device, Shockley wasn't interested. You know, what are you doing and why isn't it related to something to do with the PNPN? And, you know, it's awfully hard to tell you where to tell him where Mother Nature is going.
Yeah.
Well, we were working with a new kind of a resist. Well, how do you know it's going to work? I don't know. We thought we'd try it. Well, what kind of guarantees could you get that it might work? Or what do they know about it, you know? It was very... but it was all related to these four-layer diodes.
Right.
And fully half the staff was working on those diodes. It's not what they wanted to work on. They wanted to work on just on transistors, which would have been much smarter, because you don't have these restrictions. And transistors you make from one side. You
right.
You make from both sides. You do successive diffusions.
Do you think it was a case of... It almost sounds like William Shockley wanted to sort of skip a technological generation.
Yes, he wanted to. Yeah, he wanted, clearly a case of ego. He wanted to sell millions of these things to BTL, to Western Electric, where he came from.
Right.
To show them that here's something that will replace all those millions of mechanical switches that you have. And they would evaluate them. He would send them there and they would evaluate them. His influence was great enough to get that done, but it was a lost cause because they varied so much.
Right.
One batch, one diffusion batch would give you 40-volt devices, and another diffusion batch would give you 60-volt devices, and some would give you both because just one or two microns displacement in the space between junctions was enough to change the voltage of switchover. Mechanical switches switch at only one setting.
Right.
These things, all over the lot.
So it's really that reliability. Or
Yeah, right. And there was another problem, and that is to assemble those into a package. we had to devise our own little packages. See, you can't, all transistors and integrated circuits today are assembled from one side.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The bottom part is in the package, and the top has leads attached to another part of a package or whatever. Well, the you can do this on the PNPN switch because you can't, you won't get the same voltage if it's all contacted, if the contact is all on one side,
mm-hmm.
but on the top side there's only one.
Okay. Right.
It's going to just, there will be no reproducibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to devise a package, and one of the technicians was very good at that. He devised a package which looked like two kinked gold wires, two kinked gold stubs,
mm-hmm.
which would when pinched together would hold a little tiny 40 micron thick piece
mm-hmm.
between the two knobs of the wire, and then put that, and that would be attached to a header, and then on top of that you put a can and mm-hmm. seal it up. Well, of course, the inevitable always happened. Every once in a while, and more frequently than not, the little chip would fall out from between, it was only a physical contact, it would fall out from between the contacts. And it was working yesterday, what happened to it today?
Yeah.
Wow. And there were a lot of assembly problems.
Okay.
Well, we talked about where you were getting the black wax and the resists.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you getting, were you similarly getting your chemical supplies, like the acids from laboratory supply?
From standard, we were getting them from the Monsantos and the regular chemical houses, always looking for the CP category, the chemically pure category.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of them hadn't developed many of their chemicals to that level of purity.
Okay.
They didn't need to if they were going to etch metals.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. Why would you need to make sure that trace metals like copper weren't in there? Copper is death to a junction.
Right.
And, you know, you had to get super CP chemicals. And you can't talk Monsanto into that unless you can buy a million bottles.
So how did you get around that problem?
Well, we just learned to use it as is.
Oh,
yeah, okay. We got CP each time,
mm-hmm.
and the structure that we were working on was not that sensitive to that. We could get it copper-free, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If we could ask for something specific, they would come back with copper-free. But
okay.
Until we defined that copper was a death nail,
of course, yeah.
then what would you ask for? You want it even more pure than it is? It's already 5 9s.
Right.
And what do you want? Well, can you make it 7 9s? Well, we don't know what to do to make it 7 9s. What are you trying to avoid?
Right.
You know, you get into these discussions. Mm-hmm. You couldn't tell them. Well, when we learned copper, we could tell them that.
Okay.
If it had a little gold in it, we didn't care too much because that, we learned it didn't make too much difference. What else? But chemical purity and the use of the chemicals was a very important part of my function too.
Okay.
Mm. And that was also part of what Shockley intended for me to wander around the lab and try to do.
Okay.
The other part of my work, the largest part, was based on photoresist, on masks, on mask making.
Okay. Mm.
And in there I worked largely with Bob Noyce.
Okay.
Bob was kind of a guy that the chemical problem didn't stop him. He said, well, you mean you can't get it pure enough? Well, let's use what they have, you know. And he said, we'll see what happens.
Uh-huh.
So he could have 10 failures and see one good one, and then he'd chase after that.
Okay.
Diligence was his big number. Very tenacious and very good. Now, of course, we had to work on optical problems as well in order to expose the resists. Now, imagine that in the case of the PNPN device, which half the laboratory was working for all the time that I was there, you didn't need that.
Mm-hmm.
You only needed circles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, you could do a circle. You could take a perforated plate, stick it under a lens, shine ultraviolet through it, and you get a whole you get a whole series of mm-hmm. images of the perforated plate. Mm-hmm. Now, you'd also get whatever imperfections there are, you know, the spurs and the mm-hmm. unevenness mm-hmm. of the plate. Mm-hmm. But that was something you could do, or a metal screen.
Right.
For rectangular ones. Mm-hmm. Shockley didn't like rectangular PNPN switches.
Hmm.
He wanted them all to be the same, little round dots.
Interesting.
And I never could learn quite why. I'd say, well, look, we'll be able to do it with screens. He says, yeah, but can't you take the corners off the screens and round them off?
Just then it's never.
You know, it was, nothing stood in his way. Mm-hmm. Bob Noyce was also limited. It was also, didn't allow for limitations, but he was different. He would turn around and roll up his sleeves and go do it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Never Shockley.
Okay.
Shockley would walk away.
Okay.
And you come back maybe a week later, you still got the corners problem?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, what have you done to try to get rid of it? Well, they worked all week at it. Yeah, but what have you done? You know, show me the experiments. Very, very precise kind of a guy. But he never did it himself.
Right.
He was a supervisor.
Hmm. Actually, this might be a good place to talk about Shockley as a manager.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, of course, a lot of this is an old story with him. He was very impatient,
mm-hmm.
although he exhibited moments of patience that sometimes I wondered, you know, where mm-hmm. do they come from? Could he have more of those?
Okay.
But he was very impatient, and in particular with guys like Jay Last.
Okay.
Sheldon Roberts,
uh-huh.
and never could quite, they were there longer than I was before that. He didn't exhibit that kind of impatience with Bob Noyce
uh-huh.
or even Gordon Moore,
uh-huh.
at least not where I noticed
okay.
it.
Okay.
But I sat next to Jay Last, my bench, my desk was next to his,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
and Jay was frequently just uh-huh. totally perturbed by it. And
uh-huh.
I could swear one time he was reduced to tears by Shockley's attitude.
Uh-huh.
He just kept picking at him, you know, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? What kind of a metallurgist are you?
Oh my gosh.
And he was a metallurgist, a PhD metallurgist.
Roberts.
And Last.
Was Last, I think he had a PhD in physics.
Physics, yeah but he had a lot of work in metallurgy. Yeah, he could have been, yeah. Roberts was a PhD in metallurgy.
Right.
Jay was a physicist. We didn't mean to imply that. Jay worked a lot with Noyce, and also with me on the resist problems.
Mm-hmm.
They were intimately tied with the lenses. We had to have lenses that could expose that kind of a microscope type lenses that could expose the dots that we wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
Now that got to be a little bit tacky because working in the same laboratory was Bill Happ. You might have come across, I think Bill Happ was also from MIT, but I'm not sure.
Actually.
I really don't remember. Bill Happ was working on a field effect transistor, which seemed to be his little private corner. Shockley didn't go into that corner very often. I often wondered, what is Bill up to all those times? Hard to talk to. Nice guy outside of the place, but hard to talk. What are you doing, Bill? You know, you couldn't kid him with, tell me what you're doing and I'll tell you how to do it better, you know, this kind of thing.
Okay.
No, not Bill. He was sort of left out there in the cold, at least during the period that I noticed.
Okay.
He was working on a field effect device, which is one of those that Shockley also favored, had invented originally, but no one had yet made it in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And that would require the placement of an electrode on top of it's a three electrode device.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So it required a third electrode to be on top of the chip.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the junctions could be biased at various biases. It would be like a PNPN switch, which you could adjust the voltage on. Yeah, that would be the nature of the structure. It wasn't quite as complicated, but that would be the nature of the structure.
Mm-hmm. And he was essentially doing that.
He was
that
sort
on
of sitting in a corner for the time that I noticed he was there. When I saw him, he was sitting in a corner doing his work on field effect devices. He very seldom reported on it.
Interesting.
In fact, there was very little reporting done in public on to Shockley on anything but PNPN devices.
Okay. Did you have regular meetings of the staff or anything like
that? The only meetings that turned out to be of the staff were when the problems arose.
Okay.
When personnel problems arose, then there were several meetings held of the total staff with Shockley. But that was not in the direction of the research, the research activity. In fact, that struck me personally early in the game that I'm not, you know, he's the director of the laboratory. Well, where is all this manna from heaven going to come from?
Uh-huh.
Of all the good things that he knows about that could be worked on.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Later in my stay there, it was just about the time that the other guys left. Uh-huh. He wanted me to work on a power version of a PNPN instead of working on ones with these little leads to put it on a stud and put whiskers on the top and then work on a power version of it. It was a very good idea. So I started. He woke me up one night about 11 o'clock at night and asked me to come down to the laboratory. He had some work he wanted to discuss with me. So I went down there and he described what he wanted to do with the power device, and I began assembling the various parts, the packages, which you could get at that time, transistor-oriented packages. And only we'd have to put a PNPN chip inside, tailored to that purpose. And that meant it had to have a certain geometry, a certain diameter. Couldn't be made like the little low-voltage kinds of switches. It had to be bigger to conduct the power.
Right.
I started on that, and I conducted, I did about 2-3 months worth of work on it, and then Shockley killed the project. It just ran out of his purview. But by that time, we were already in personnel problems.
Before we talk about the, you know, when the personnel problems got really bad, that eventually led to that group of guys leaving. I just wanted to ask maybe two questions. One was, were you growing your own silicon crystals at Shockley?
Yes, there was.
And slicing them?
Good question. Yes, we had Dean Napick with us. And Dean had had worked out in the time I was there. He had actually worked out before. He had worked out a sort of a contracting arrangement with Shockley, where we didn't have room for the crystal growers in that little space. So Dean went off and got a lease on some space. So he was where he put up a couple of, I forget, at least two crystal growers, where he was pulling these half-inch crystals, the little ones. And he would supply us with silicon, according to the resistivity that wanted, basically for PNPN diodes. That was our silicon source.
Would he deliver them as wafers?
No, they would deliver them as the whole crystal.
Uh-huh.
We had to saw that, we had to cut them. Okay. And we had a very good shop meister, who, Gene, suddenly slipped me, who had set up a rig, I'll think of his name in a minute, who had set up a rig to slice. You could get saws, and you could slice hard material. And you had your usual losses. Of course, these wafers had to be very thin, but that you did after you saw them too thick, you had a hell of a lot more lapping. but that was Gene supplied us with little rigs, little experimental apparatuses. He built a small base to measure the heat dissipation of these power devices that I was supposed to try to make. And he worked very closely with me on that. Very bright guy, a very good machinist. And it would have been a credit to any laboratory. But that's where that work came from.
Could it be Gene Troyer?
Yes, okay. Troyer. Good work. Okay. Troyer. Okay. Must be because it's French-oriented, huh?
he moved to fashion afterwards, right?
Yes, he did, for a short time. You guys have been doing your homework.
Well, Christoph knows it backward and forward.
You have to be careful.
Yeah, that's right.
The NAPIC only has one P.
Oh.
Don't let anybody spell it with double P. I saw something come through. I got an inquiry. Do you remember what happened to NAPIC? Oh, it was one of the guys who was present who was just recently working with the Shockley transistor, Clevite.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he wanted to know that it was Andy Ward, or Andy wanted to know, whatever happened to Gene to NAPIC? Yeah. Well, anyway.
Yeah. And you mentioned that one of the reasons, my other question was, one of the reasons, I guess, that NAPIC went and got his own space was the laboratory was pretty small. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit more just the sort of physical... The physical plant.
Very
in those
simply,
days.
It was a it was just a square, open space. It was a warehouse,
mm-hmm.
and it was in the shape of this table.
Mm-hmm.
Much bigger, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A hell of a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. There are some diagrams around somewhere about mm-hmm. the space,
mm-hmm.
but it was a square, open space.
Mm-hmm.
The only enclosures were one for Shockley, and one for his accountant,
mm-hmm.
and the accountant's secretary at one end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Shockley also had, in addition to his own little office space, he had built an enclosure across the width of it, like along here.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So there was a couple. There were a couple of swinging doors that you went through that isolated the noise and the dust of the laboratory area
mm-hmm.
from the office, from those office areas.
Oh, I see.
All the other people sat within the workspace.
Mm-hmm.
We sat like little dummies in a row.
Okay.
There was Roberts, Last, me, and Sam Folk, all
okay.
four of us
okay.
in one row.
Okay.
And then there was a row of several other guys, Gordon Moore and a couple other guys in another row, but inside the workspace.
Mm. Okay. Okay.
It wasn't very big, so it didn't. And then it had one whole corner was occupied by Gene Troyer's
okay. shop.
Shop.
Okay.
And another smaller corner was entitled the conference room,
okay.
which it built a box, partitioned off a box, and you went in there to have meetings when
mm-hmm.
the meetings were held.
Okay.
It was used a lot during the troubled times.
Yeah.
And I could always tell when these guys were up to something because they'd always use the conference room to have their, they didn't want to do it off site because they'd never be around. And I wasn't excluded from them, but I didn't attend everyone.
Hmm. Well, could you, what do you think, Christoph?
Maybe a good time now to talk about the your co-workers, and I mean people like Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce. And,
well, I mean, we started with Noyce. Noyce was the leader,
uh-huh.
no question about it.
Uh-huh.
He knew semiconductor work because
uh-huh.
he had been at Philco,
uh-huh.
although it was germanium.
Okay.
So he was the semiconductor guru. Whenever anybody wanted to know something about semiconductors, he'd consult Noyce.
Okay.
Or transistors, they had he had been experienced
okay.
in making Philco's high-frequency transistors out of germanium.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only one with germanium experience.
Mm-hmm.
None of us had that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was the leader. The he wasn't... He didn't have the title of a leader. He was still a member of senior staff. We
okay.
were all
okay.
members of senior staff.
Okay.
But that didn't bother,
okay.
to, the way I noticed, it didn't bother any of us, not out in public anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But he was a, sort of the titular leader. He
okay.
had a
okay.
problem on a device or a problem on where to go for effort in this transistor
okay.
business.
Okay.
He went to Noyce.
Okay.
Gordon was the diffuser.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Gordon built and... he was a diffuser and furnace maker
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and glass blower. He's a very good glass blower.
Mm.
Not commonly appreciated. He doesn't like that to be known. He didn't like that to be known because everybody wanted him to make something. Sheldon Roberts and Last worked on... Roberts worked on metallurgical problems having to do with dislocations
mm-hmm.
and structure, internal structural problems in silicon.
Mm-hmm.
Decorating dislocations, such things as we're using the dash etch.
Okay.
and working at all the analytical tools, metallurgical analytical tools, lapping problems, and so forth.
Okay.
Roberts later on was the one who solved the famous episode of the pin, which you probably heard about.
Oh, the push pin.
The push pin that Shockley felt somebody had placed to try to get him. And Roberts simply took the pin out of the wall, stuck it under the microscope, and saw it was a thumbtack which had broken off. Shockley never believed that.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't believe it.
Okay.
Jay Last worked on optical problems with Noyce.
Mm-hmm.
And Noyce was mostly on optical problems as well. Although he was a very talented device man.
Okay.
Vic Greenwich was the electrical engineer,
mm-hmm.
brilliant electrical engineer. He was the device measurement specialist.
Okay.
Bill Happ, we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where Bill came from, but he had a well-known degree. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he was
mm-hmm.
well-trained, but he was working on a field effect device when he was working. Sam Folk. Sam was a chemical engineer. And Sam had come there shortly before I had, and he was working on crystal pulling problems. Over and above what NAPIC was doing to supply. In fact, Sam was trying to build, in fact, got most of it done, build a crystal pour on the premises. A very good chemical engineer.
Okay.
Were you having problems with the material from NAPIC, or was it just...
No, I think it was just standard problem. It would be problems that had a start with NAPIC. Maybe it was the starting material that he bought.
Right.
Something like that. But he was... He was pretty good at it. There were very limited sources for single crystals in silicon at that time.
Mm-hmm.
If you could cadge one, Shockley would cadge some material from BTL or something like that, from Theurer at BTL, you'd get that kind of material.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, going down the cadre, Gene Troyer we mentioned as the machine shop, and you know, the trial structures builder, the what do you call them? If you want a little jigs, special little jigs,
mm-hmm.
Special little mechanical jigs for accomplishing certain jobs, and fast turnaround. Then why does it slip me all of a sudden? Julie Blank. Let's leave him for a moment. Julie Blank was a mechanical engineer, not a PhD, but he was acquisition of equipment.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Gene Kleiner worked on facilities and space. And those two were always seen together. All the planning that they had to do. I left out.
It was around that time that Jim Gibbons joined the group, right?
Jim Gibbons' arrival is a bit later than
this. Okay.
I think he might have come once or twice when the group was still there.
Oh, I see, okay.
But mostly Jim arrived as a consultant afterwards.
Okay.
I met Jim there, but it was after the group had left.
Okay.
There's, was Tom Saw there?
Yeah, C.T. Saw. Oh, don't forget him. C.T. Saw, brilliant physicist.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess his degree is in chemical engineering. Hold on. Very modest guy, but God, he was sharp.
What sorts of things was he working on at the time?
C.T. Saw was working on recombination rates in silicon.
Oh.
And in fact, he and Noyce and Shockley put out a landmark paper called The Recombination in Silicon PN Junctions. Brilliant paper. He just he went on later at Fairchild, even at Fairchild, to work on surface control devices. MOS circle. Nothing better has been written about MOS structures than what C.T. Saw has written. He was brilliant. He was just a kid then. He was only a year out of Fairchild, a year out of Stanford.
Okay.
And he used to stay up late at night. And I said, Tom, don't you sleep? He says, one time, he said, here, I'll show you where. And he took me out in the back lot where he parked, had a parking car. He slept in his car overnight. He'd work very late and go out to sleep in his car and come back in the morning.
Wow.
He was really a dynamo. Not too communicative as a person, but excellent as a silicon structural theoretician. I can't say that he was the equal of Shockley, but I find very little difference in relative to their experience, allowing for that. And of course, he stayed. He did not leave with the group. And he he was working on MOS structures even then, but he was mostly working on the detailed diffusion of phosphorus in silicon. And he and I put two papers together on the masking effects of oxide on the diffusion of phosphorus in silicon. That was the beam diffusion that was done. He was a solid-state physicist. That guy was just sharp. And he was a bit shy. He didn't like the whole idea of this whole thing that was going on. He just stayed aloof from it. But I very seldom saw him communicating to Shockley. I know Shockley had a lot of respect for him, especially when they did that paper. That paper was written just before I arrived.
Okay.
The recombination rates in silicon PN junctions. Saw Noyce and Shockley. Terrific paper. And he carried on with his junction, his device junction work, and the MOS structures, even all through the time I was there, and then through the time we both got employed by Fairchild. A very shy kind of a guy, reticent, but still quite forthright.
You know?
He didn't mess around. He didn't mince words.
On technical matters.
Technical matters, right.
Yeah.
He did not get involved in any of the discussions, and I didn't talk to him too much about it because he didn't like it. He didn't want to be part of that. And he and I had a conversation, probably if he hadn't been there, working, maybe I would have left with that group. I don't know. I've often thought about it. Maybe. Hard to say. But I stayed, I have to say, I stayed because I was only recently arrived with Shockley. And I couldn't believe, I couldn't put 100% credibility on all of the reasons that Shockley wasn't a good research director. He was still a Nobel Prize winner. He was still as brilliant as ever. Did we mention, I mentioned Gordon Moore.
I think.
Who were we missing?
We're missing Jean-Ernie.
Yeah.
Ernie, lovely guy. Jean-Ernie was prince of a guy. But Jean-Ernie lived in a motel, and he did nothing but work out diffusion curves. Diffusion curves from solid sources or diffusion curves from moving fronts. And he just wrote all the, he wrote the whole text for diffusion structures that we use at Shockley and that were used later at Fairchild.
Okay, wow.
And he worked in a, by himself. Gordon put it a nice way one time when he was asked what Jean-Ernie does, and he listed out similarly, and he said, well, Jean-Ernie, he sits around and thinks. very lovable guy, very disturbed by Shockley, by the Shockley attitudes. He was completely a part of the group that had been offended by Shockley. And he worked out, and he's of course the inventor of the oxide covered junction. As such, the precursor to an integrated, to Noyce's integrated circuit.
Mm.
So he was a very vital part of it. The only time you saw him was at lunch at Ricky's or something like that, when the group met for lunch. Occasionally would run over, call up Jean, get him out of his motel, let's go have lunch. We'll tell him what we're doing, you know. He was definitely a part of the team.
Okay.
Did we talk about Greenwich? Vic Greenwich?
Yeah, about
electrical instrumentation.
Right.
The excellent electric. And he was later the first head of Fairchild's fledgling instrumentation division.
Mm-hmm.
That they later formed at Fairchild.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we talk a little bit about how the just the personnel problems start to develop from your perspective and how, you know, some of your co-workers seem to form this?
That's a good question. I knew there were problems right from the beginning because Noyce and Moore, at their house, at Moore's house, mm-hmm. took me aside and said, we don't want to influence whether you should come here or not, but we do want to tell you that mm-hmm. we feel there are problems.
Mm-hmm.
And Shockley is just impossible to get along with. Mm-hmm. And he has offended so many of us so much of the time. No, I didn't feel that when they were describing that they were personally offended.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't come through.
Okay.
But the group was offended.
Okay. Mm.
And Shockley was impossible to talk to. He very seldom came to consult with them.
Mm-hmm.
They just did their work, worked on what they thought was important. And they were very much concerned about the fact that they should not be making the PNPN diode.
Mm-hmm.
They should be making field effect transistors. I mean, transistors, three terminal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because those had been demonstrated to work, and there a lot of work had to be done on them. And they did that work on the side. I wouldn't say bootlegged it, but they did it in connection with their other work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Shockley didn't like that. He didn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And as I sat there and looked at them from day to day, I did not see much interaction between them. Occasionally, one or more of the other guys would go into the office, mm-hmm. into Shockley's office for a one-on-one conference.
Yeah.
Ostensibly about the work he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the result of one of those meetings that Jay Lass was practically in tears.
Mm.
I think I mentioned that
last
time. Mm. He had gotten such a dressing down from Shockley, words to the effect that I overheard of, I don't know how you qualified for a PhD.
Mm.
And that just broke him up.
Absolutely.
It really was not a very happy thing. It affected everybody.
Mm.
I was affected by it as well, but at the same time, I didn't know what Jay did.
Right.
What was it that he was doing, or what he did, that had Shockley asked him to do something and they just didn't perform, or something like this? I didn't know that. And I didn't know that as well about Gordon or Bob Noyce. To my observations, he did not carry out the same kind of critique of those two guys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he might have privately, but I didn't hear it.
Well, in talking to Gordon Moore, he said that he had a perfectly
good relationship.
Between the two of them, and he attributed a bit to the fact of his area of expertise was sort
different
of
than Shockley's.
Yeah, he wasn't a physicist.
Exactly what I attributed mine to.
Yeah, the very
exactly,
similar.
Very same. And that was also part of the reason why, in my relatively recent arrival, I decided to stay on.
Sure.
Shockley, he was decent to me. He was critical in that series of experiments I had elected to do on the power PNPN.
Mm-hmm.
But the experiments were the ones that he was criticizing. I had done a cross matrix of experiments, and he pointed out very clearly, he said, look, after your first two sets of experiments, you, if you had done this one and that one and that one, you'd know the answer. But you're shooting blind.
Oh.
But it was the critique of the matrix of experiments, and it was perfectly reasonable.
Hmm.
And we had, early on, we had talks about the differences between us.
Between you and Shockley. Me,
yeah, yeah. That I was a chemist, okay. Physical chemist, and Shockley wasn't.
Okay.
And I had to explain to him what a ternary diagram was. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned some mm-hmm. of this. And mm-hmm. that was the time he asked me only one question. He said, can you derive the...
Oh, yeah.
the sum of the various altitudes are 100%, which I did with much struggling. But... we had a good relationship. I wasn't there long enough to be party to the outside conferences that were being carried on at the time about so-and-so last Roberts, they want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. The other guys are trying to talk him into not leaving.
I see.
All that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I never got into those kinds of conference, although I was at once asked, we're going to be doing this and you're welcome to join us if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But only asked, I wasn't, I was asked only once. Asked me twice more now, yeah. And I'll tell you.
Who asked you? Do you remember?
Gordon. Yeah.
And Gordon. That must have been right before they were...
Just before they left, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
They
said, we can use you. We can use you at Fairchild, at another place. So you're invited to come with us. It was nice to feel that. But,
sure.
It was that feeling, that versus breaking away from Shockley.
Right. Someone your own age, yeah, who's...
Right. And it couldn't... it didn't have the guts to... foresee the thing or something.
Yeah.
Something wasn't right. I could not point to a bad experience with Shockley.
Right.
Nor could I point to a bad experience with anyone who had a bad experience with Shockley, other than by hearsay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wasn't present when Jay was chewed out, or I wasn't present when other guys were bitterly criticized and felt they had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, all of us, were... to a lesser or greater degree, we're kind of prima donnas in a way. And that prima donna isn't the word. Mm-hmm. Very sensitive to their technical status.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I had been beaten about in Shell for 6 years, so I was already part of a cadre that... took that kind of stuff on.
Right. Well, you weren't alone in really deciding to keep with Shockley, because, you know, I guess Arnold Beckman made a decision, you know, a management decision,
to
keep Shockley as the manager of the organization.
That was while I was there.
Could you describe that?
Beckman came down one time, and he gave a little talk in which he recognized that there had been difficulties. There had been what was the term he used? Chafings or words like that. Difficulties mm-hmm. with the crew, with Shockley, mm-hmm. and he did feel, and he had already talked with the group as a group a couple of times, and he said he felt that there was a sufficient reason to criticize Shockley's, constructively criticize Shockley's attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, after all, he is the head of the laboratory and he's a Nobel Prize winner. And he said he wants to suggest, and he would carry on, that they would appoint another manager.
Mm-hmm.
That the manager would run the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And that Shockley would be responsible only for the experimentation. Only for the science.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the manager would be in charge of the personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And he later did that. It was Maurice Hannafin.
Right.
his talk was taken, and rightly taken, as a decision point. Mm-hmm. He had already talked to the group by themselves without Shockley. I was not present at those discussions. Those occurred earlier. Mm-hmm. He had already talked to them more than once, and they described their various problems and what they wanted to do that Shockley didn't want to do. And it was mostly in connection with the experimental programs. Mm-hmm.
This so transistor this, versus yeah, the right, diode.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Why only the diode? Why can't we work on the other stuff that we can get out fast and make product and sell it? They were very, very economically conscious, mm-hmm. which Shockley wasn't. Not at all. And it was very tough to take. Shockley was only conscious of wanting to impress BTL and flood them with chips that could take the place of all their switches and to show what he could do relative to silicon that they couldn't do at BTL any other way. Very important to him to do that. Hmm. So this talk with Beckman was the culmination of decision making, that Hanifin would show up, which he did, and that was, and Shockley stays on.
Was Shockley there for that?
No, he was not there for that.
It was just Arnold Beckman and everybody else?
Arnold Beckman and everybody else, mm-hmm. right. And he himself was a very high status individual. Arnold Beckman was well known and he was respected. They all did, we all did. But they were, at that talk, it was the decision point. Mm-hmm.
And then it was not long thereafter.
Right thereafter, yeah. Very quickly. When they saw Hanifin arrive, when Hanifin arrived and we saw that it was a done deal,
okay.
then they had checked out.
Okay. Hmm. Well, do you have a question?
Was there some, there could be gray area here, yeah. fuzzy on.
Well, I just know that, I mean, it's very clear the way that you've described it. Mm-hmm. I guess I was wondering, how did you find out that these eight of your coworkers quit? How did you find out?
Oh, they told us. I mean, they told us they were checking out. You know, they turned mm-hmm. in their resignations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, you know, after Hanifin mm-hmm. arrived. And they told us, they told several of us that this is what they were doing. And that was when they also reiterated that, look, if you still feel you want to take off for some other reason, please talk to us.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I have to say that they did not exclude me from the participation. They paid great respect to the fact that I had just recently arrived with Shockley.
Sure.
I don't know whether they talked with Sa. I know if they did, Sa was pretty adamant about this. He was on his own little, in his own little shelf.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like that's a pretty large fraction of the core, you know, technical group.
Yeah, you can see what it is, yeah.
It's a big group, a big loss. How did that affect... how did it affect you? How did it affect Shockley? And how did it affect the work?
Well, of course, the work was affected greatly. Everybody who was left had a turn too on making PNPN diodes. Mm-hmm. There was no room to make anything else.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Those who wanted to were gone. and Hanifin had just arrived, but it took him a while to take hold and come in on the scene. And in my first conversations with him, he said, look, we're moving the PNPN diode over to the Beckman building in Palo Alto. And there's where all the assembly is going to take place. And, oh, we didn't mention the other guys that stayed, what's his name? Did I get Sam Folk in there?
Yeah.
Sam.
Yeah.
The guy from Oregon didn't contact him. There was Elmer Brown, mm-hmm. was the technician, mm-hmm. and Smoot Horsley.
Oh, yeah.
Smoot Horsley wasn't worth a shit. I'm sorry. Smoot Harsley was a non-entity to me. Mm-hmm. He was Shockley's lackey.
Okay. He was a scientist.
He was a scientist. Yeah. He was a PhD. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who was put in charge of the PNPN operation from the beginning. And in charge of trying to get the cooperation of other people to do that. And he did that. The others did cooperate. Not to, I don't know to what he felt about the satisfaction. I got along with him fairly well, but I didn't think he was very effective.
As a scientist?
As a scientist, right. He was just word for word Shockley's a man. Everything that Shockley wanted to do, he did.
So they moved the PNPN work the assembly to the SPINCO?
To SPINCO division, yes, thank you.
Right.
Of Beckman in Palo Alto. And then Hanifin started to come around and try to be a manager.
Was he between the two locations then?
Yes.
Okay.
Mostly he was at SPINCO. Mm-hmm. Because he was concerned very much about the economic viability of the PNPN.
Oh.
That was a number one concern in his book, because that had been a big problem the first time around. Anybody want more tea? I'm going to have to wet my whistle a little bit.
Sure.